listeners, you are listening to another episode of Beckett's Babies, a playwriting podcast. On the show, we discuss plays we love, interview theater artists, and share thoughts on playwriting and theater. We are your hosts, Sarah Cho.
And Sam Collier. And today's guest is Lucas Baish, a playwright from San Francisco, currently based in Brooklyn. Lucas is an instructor at Pratt, a workspace resident with the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, and playgroup member at Ars Nova, and his play 404 Not Found is about to be published by 53rd State Press. Lucas, welcome to the show.
Hi. Hello.
We're so excited to have you as a guest.
Yes, I'm so excited. This is my first podcast.
What?
Yeah, okay, I guess, like, why else would a playwright ever be on a podcast?
Well, I hope it will be a good experience for you. Yeah. So we like to start off all our interviews by asking our guests about their earliest memories. So what's the first thing you remember?
That's such a funny question, because when I was reading it in, like, your prompts, I had such trouble excavating, like, an answer. That I feel like the earliest thing I can remember was from when I was 5, which is kind of late in the game. But, like, I don't know. Did you experience, like, childhood injuries? Like, did y'all ever have to, like, go to the ER when you were kids? Yeah, I mean, I had a pretty bad one when I was 5 in kindergarten. My brother accidentally hit me in the head with a 9-iron golf club.
Accidentally, yeah, right.
Well, yeah, I mean, we had a weird relationship growing up, but it was pretty accidental. I would give him that, because it was, like, a hard thing.
Okay.
But, God, he was in so much trouble, because he wasn't supposed to be. He was, like, practicing his swing or whatever. but, like, I was, like, you know, I'm 4 years younger than him, and I was running around behind him. And right when he swung backwards, he made contact with the side of my head, which is crazy, because if it was, like, a mere inches over, you know, it would have smashed my face. But it ended up, like, cutting my ear open, and went to the ER. I remember being, like, kind of, like, experiencing a concussion. So, like, my mom, like, had my brothers in the backseat, like, ask me really kind of basic questions, like, what's your favorite color? What's your favorite food? Blah, 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 just to, like, stay awake.
Wow.
But the thing that really sticks with me, and I feel like this has, like, coded my relationship to, like, imagery of violence, like, throughout my life. I remember they only put, like, local anesthesia on my ear to do the stitches. Like, I didn't have to, it wasn't invasive or anything. But as the doctor was stitching my ear, we were in a dark room, and he had a headlamp on, and he had glasses on. Mm-hmm. So as he was stitching, I realized I could see my, like, mangled ear in the reflection of his glasses.
Whoa.
And I just started, like, screaming.
Yeah.
Take your glasses off. So, like, witnessing your own kind of, like, maimed body.
That shows up in a lot of your work, I think.
Yeah, it was really intense. But then part of me is, like, I remember telling my dad this maybe, like, 10 years ago, and my dad is a doctor, and we were at the hospital that he works at, and he was like, that doctor doesn't wear glasses. Like, he was kind of, like, gaslighting me, and I was like, Dad, I totally remember this happening. Like, he could have just been wearing glasses, like, for the stitching. I don't know. So part of me is, like, what did I fabulate, you know, as a child? But I like to believe it's true.
That's fascinating, because I have memories from being around that age that I'm like, I only realized pretty recently that were probably dreams. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know, so much of that early childhood is fuzzy, or things that I believed to be true for years, and then it was like, oh, actually there's no way that could have happened.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. That's, I feel like, Sarah, have we had another early memory that was like a memory of a traumatic injury? This is really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think this has to be the first where you, like, you saw the actual, you know, the doctor working. And that's, oh, that got goosebumps thinking about that, because, oh, I just don't like the ER.
Yeah, no, same.
Yeah.
I mean, freaky if anyone does like the ER.
yeah.
It's interesting, though. I should send you all this picture I have, because I remember my kindergarten school photos were, like, the week after that injury. And for a while I had to, so like the scarring wouldn't be so intense, they had to like Vaseline my ear every day. Mm. So if you look at my kindergarten photo, it's so funny. It like, you see my right ear is like kind of glisteny and like metallic, and it kind of looks like I have this like zombie ear. I should say, it's really funny. Yeah.
All right. This is a great visceral place to begin.
Yeah.
And then, oh, so were you, how did you get into theater? Were you a kid who was doing theater from an early age, or did that happen later?
Well, like, you know, I think many parents who are involved in their children's lives try to figure out what are the activities that will kind of engine them through their adolescence. And, you know, I did like some sports as a kid, but I wasn't very like assertive. I was pretty shy. I was a pretty quiet kid. And I think my parents registered that. So they put me in like community theater classes, like I think around like second or third grade or something. And I really like glommed onto that. And I ended up, I really didn't like, so my parents were divorced. I grew up both in like the city of San Francisco, but the suburbs, the south suburbs, South Bay suburbs. And I really didn't like going to school in the suburbs. Like, I think I knew from an early age, I was like, these are not my people. This doesn't feel right. So when I was transitioning from middle school to high school, I sought out like this arts high school that is in San Francisco.
Oh, cool.
The Ruth Asawa School of the Arts, that you have to like audition for. And, you know, it's a public school, but like a magnet public school, like you have to get in through audition. So I asked my parents if I could switch school districts, and they were super supportive of that transition. I mean, it came with like a lot of weird compromise. But yeah, I ended up going to this like really intensive like actor training program when I was in high school, is so funny because I feel like many people's like high school relationship to drama is one of being like really nerdy and like kind of social outcasts. When I found like that, you know, the 20 of us that were in my class really took it like so seriously. You know, we were reading like Tony Kushner and Ibsen and like everything that's canonized and being like, we are doing scene study, we are here till 8 p.m. like
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, probably toxic in some ways when I look back on like how the training functioned, but it introduced me to playwriting super early because that was like a part of our curriculum. And I, you know, I feel like I tell this story all the time, but I was like a pretty like piece of shit. Like I wanted to be esoteric. Like I wanted to have like, an individual interest that no one else held. Like I hated like sharing and copying as a kid were like big issues for me. I was like, I am an Aquarius. I want to be an individual. so like I made playwriting like the thing I was going to do. So when I applied to undergrad programs, I only applied to playwriting programs, you know, of which there's like seven maybe in the country that are like named that. But, you know, that's what like led me to Chicago. And like, Sam, that's honestly what led me to meeting you, is like I met Bonnie through there. And then I met, you know, it really set off an early trajectory for me, which I appreciate.
Because you went to DePaul, is that right?
Yeah. I went to theater school at DePaul.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So when did you start writing plays?
Yeah, I mean, I started writing like short plays in high school.
Yeah.
But then really going to DePaul, it was like a conservatory BFA program. And you don't really start writing plays. Their curriculum was very thoughtful in my understanding of it. Like you spend your first year doing crew and script analysis and the history of dramatic literature, and then you really jump into the writing your second through fourth year. And I wrote, you know, it was a super small program. Like in my graduating BFA playwriting class, there were two of us, so we got a lot of it felt like comparable to a graduate education, even though I was like an idiot 20-year-old, you know. But it meant like a lot of writing and like a lot of like disciplined writing, you know, churning out a lot of pages every week and like production.
Yeah.
My time there, which was kind of crazy. Like I remember like experiencing that production my senior year of undergrad and being like, I'm never going to have like a production of this kind of value and caliber ever again. Like I was very aware of how rare that experience was. But it's interesting because it made it like super different when I ended up going to grad school, or even just like working in Chicago between undergrad and grad school. You know, because Chicago, as you know, Sam, and I'm not sure, Sarah, if you're familiar with Chicago as a theater town, but it's very like DIY kind of storefront sensibility, working with like little means.
Yeah.
Which I really appreciated, you know, as a young playwright, I guess.
Yeah. And it feels like those little storefront theaters have as much, or I don't know, they're just, they're seen to be significant and valuable in a way that in other cities, I don't know, they might not be.
Yeah. I mean, I found that it was like an incredibly tight community, sometimes like too tight. sometimes I was like, we all need to like do other things, you know?
And
I
actually, people.
I kind of like tactfully like stepped in and out of those spheres because it did feel a little myopic sometimes there. Mm. Like incredible work being done, but also very like aesthetically myopic, like really like leading with the foundation of like naturalism, American realism, you know, linear time. And that didn't also, that didn't feel like correct in my view of theater making. I wanted to make weirder things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you went and did an MFA.
Yeah. Yeah. I took 3 years between. And then I moved to Providence to go to Brown, which was a wild time as well.
For people who are listening and thinking about doing an MFA, it might be helpful for you. I'm not necessarily asking you to say do it or don't do it, but what were some of the things you were weighing when you were deciding whether or not to apply to MFA programs?
Sure. I mean, definitely the thing I just said of like the aesthetic myopia of Chicago. You know, I was working at the MCA at the time, which I was really grateful for. So this is the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago. And at the time, they had like a really robust performance program formerly run by Peter Taub and Yolanda Sestak-Kersach. And they'd been running it since the 90s. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist in like the same kind of framework. But they were bringing in like such formally inventive work, and not just theater, but like music, dance, and things that kind of like intermingled between those disciplines. A lot of international work. And I was so excited by that. And I was just like very aware that there was a world beyond Chicago that I wanted to exist in. The other thing that was specific to Brown for me was that Eric N., who was the head at the time, who is this very fascinating playwright.
yeah.
Very like monastic, you know, went to seminary, godly figure. He was an artistic associate with a theater company that one of my teachers ran in high school.
Cool.
This like Noen Kyogen theater called Theater Yugen that is in San Francisco, like Japanese traditional theater, but doing like contemporary versions of Noen Kyogen theater. And they worked with Eric, and I met him when I was 16. He did this show at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. And I remember reading like his plays. He has this collection called The Saint Plays that are like adaptations of different saint figures into short plays. And I remember reading that concurrently with Angels in America. And I was like, wow, theater can be so much more, right? Like it can be so big. Right. So like Brown was something that was like always in my mind, like since I was like a kid and since I knew he was there. The funny thing is he accepted me and then he left the program, which is kind of like such a beautiful confrontation with reality when I look back at it. And it's totally fine. Like I've sustained a relationship with him since. Like I saw him in like New Mexico like a year and a half ago, which was kind of its own experience. But
yeah, that's so just life.
You had a chance to interact maybe during like the interview process and stuff, but then as soon as you got there, he was gone.
Yeah, I mean, even before I ended up there, like, we knew he was leaving. So it was kind of chaotic. It kind of, like, demythologized the idea of, like, grad school immediately, which I really helpful. So, like, I guess that's the thing. For people listening and thinking about, like, MFA programs, like, good to strip it of its romanticism immediately, I would say.
I don't know. I feel like I spent the first few months of my MFA program in this cloud of, like, romanticism that I would not give up. I mean, it'll strip itself away eventually. I think there's no need to hurry it along.
For me, Sam, in Iowa, for me, it was like, that first few months. And as soon as winter hit, I was like, what the F is? And it was like, the winter was going to, like, May, like, snowing till May. And I was like, this is ridiculous. I stopped romanticizing, like, second day of snow. So
that's so fun.
Yeah.
Wow. Ugh. Seasonality. Yeah. I would also, like, just recommend people don't necessarily take out a bunch of loans to go to grad school.
Mm-hmm. Like,
it's not worth it. There, especially in this field, like, there is no, like, MFA to professionalism pipeline that I think people are convinced of. I actually think, like, people are pretty sober on that now. Like, I think we all recognize how stupid MFAs are. Or at least I hope people do. Like, I remember reading, like, a Junot Diaz article or something before I went to Brown. And he was like, yeah, I got my MFA, but, like, it's not the answer. And I was like, you're so smug. Of course you can say that. Like, you went to one.
Right.
And sometimes I feel that way when I'm being critical of it. But I do think it's good to, like, unpack how icky they can be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I had a great time. I mean, it's complicated, but I don't regret it at all.
Would you say that you're... Like, if you're thinking about the kinds of things you write starting in high school to through your BFA and then the years in Chicago and then through your MFA, are there certain things you keep returning to in your work, and or how have you seen your work change through those different kinds of programs?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the language is constantly, like, molting that I use around, like, the categories of my interests. But, I mean, I think lately the things I think a lot about, and they're pretty vague umbrella terms, are, like, systems and excess, you know, waste and discard. I think, like, as I'm moving into, like, more scholarly work, I'm thinking about, like, objects and how we interact with, like, trash. What are, like, the semiotics of trash? Like, my first play was about hoarders and, like, in this landscape of garbage, which to me was more just, like, a spectacular image, right?
Yeah.
But I think over the years, as I've, like, really, like, delved into, like, theory and, like, just all of the exposure with so many different performance artists, I'm thinking about that. In terms of systems, like, it used to mean, like, tech. Like, I used to mean, like, tech ethics. Thinking about that. Because I'm from, you know, the Bay, from San Francisco, like, it's a way for me to, like, kind of understand / come to terms with, you know, the culture there since, like, the dot-com boom of the 90s. But I also think it's opened up more just, like, thinking about, you know, systems of waste, systems of capital, racial inequity, neoliberalism, et cetera, et cetera.
This is sort of slightly sidestepping, but have you heard of this, like, tech billionaires buying a bunch of land, farmland up in NorCal, and, like, they want to build their own city?
Yeah. I mean, there's many utopian or utopic commune societies in Northern California that want to secede. They kind of creep me out. I mean, it really is like Summer of Love era people who, like, escaped to the Redwoods and started weed farming and, like, supposedly hold these very liberal ideals, but are actually, like, kind of racist and, like, anti-vaxxers. So, like, there's this weird Ouroboros of culture up there. And it's so funny because it's, like, such an incredibly beautiful landscape, but there is, like, this sinister underbelly.
Wow.
Yeah.
When you say secede, like secede from the state of California or from?
Yeah.
Wow. That's fascinating.
I know.
Yeah, for a long time, they're always trying to be like Northern California and then Southern California, like have two states.
Mm-hmm.
It's a constant like battle.
Yeah. Weird vibes.
Yeah.
Weird vibes. I was just in the Bay for a while. At this residency.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I mean adjacent. Like it was kind of like the Santa Cruz Mountains, which is South Bay. But like, you know, there's one day we like did a sound bath.
Whoa.
like I'm not morally opposed to, like I'm like, sure, whatever. Like a thing you want to do, like let's do it and I'll try it. And the guy who ran it is very sweet. And he was like a local guy, this dude named Danny. But he was also like, yeah, I do this for like Google and like tech people. And it was just so funny to me. Like when you macroscope out and think about tech people kind of bridging with kind of woo-woo communities that
right.
in a kind of like mysticism.
You just described Boulder, Colorado.
I mean... When I was in New Mexico, it felt the same. Like, it's really like an appropriation of indigenous culture, right?
It's
like,
so bizarre. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, can you describe what the sound bath was like?
I mean, a bunch of like bowls, metal bowls. One got like placed on my chest. It was actually interesting because I was having like extreme like tooth pain like at the time.
Oh my gosh. Did it help?
Like, no, not really. But I was like, maybe it'll help it. Yeah, I remember going into it like, ah, yes, maybe this will heal my nerves. It didn't. But, you know, it was cool. It was nice. It was a good experience. Do a sound bath. Yeah.
Have you ever been attracted to working in other art forms? And if so, which ones?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always been like closer with like visual artists in my life.
Mm.
And I like the idea of presenting theater in the context of like other arts discipline spaces, whether that's in like galleries, museums, or like even non-capital T theater spaces. It's always interesting to like try and like convince non-theater artists that a play is worthwhile, you know?
I know. Like, I run up against that constantly.
I kind of love it, though, because I'm like, I feel like it really, it's kind of like teaching, right? It's kind of like when your students challenge you on, like, terms.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I have to, like, really hold myself accountable with, like, either the thing I'm showing you or the thing I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been so beautiful to, like, introduce, like, people to, I mean, I just, from my residency, I met up with one of my friends who's a composer who lives in Queens. And we went to a play the other day and it was great. He never really sees plays. So it was really nice.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. And I think like personally, like I like that kind of like nefarious, like skipping around the boundary of like theater and like visual art world. Like I've done so many like residencies meant for visual artists where like being a playwright is such a novel and strange thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then similarly, I think like when I'm in like theater spaces, you know, sure it can be like deemed being like experimental, but sometimes I challenge that word because I'm like, what are we talking about when we say experimental?
Right.
But being interested in like other disciplines and like how do you bridge that discipline to theater? Like, I like that feeling. The feeling of otherness, I guess, is a comfortable feeling.
The going back to the Aquarian desire to be.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So if we were to pretend we were a podcast about visual art and Sarah and I were painters.
Hell yeah.
And you had to explain to us why theater is valuable. What would you say?
Yeah. I mean, plays are cool. They, you know, are afforded this ability to be like simultaneously like a literary art and a performance art, which I think is super cool. I love that they're ephemeral, that like really you can work on something in perpetuity. There's something really beautiful and like paradoxical about that. I love that in play space, you know, unlike other narrative media like film and television, where you're like telling the viewer what to look at through the kind of plane, the like camera plane,
right?
You're in three-dimensional space, right? So like audiences actually have a lot more agency, and collaboration with the play, because they're curating their own experience, right? By like paying attention to what they want to pay attention to, which I find really powerful.
Oh, I love that way of, that way of looking at it. I completely agree.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Plays are like weird too. Like they like almost shouldn't exist, right? And so often,
what do you mean?
Well, because they exist as like speculative things for such a long time, right? Like when you write a play, like who knows if it's ever going to exist. Right. And then like the accident of it existing is so exciting.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh, yeah.
Yeah, was that good? Did you like that?
Oh, I'm convinced.
Same.
Cool, nice.
No, I feel like you like beautifully described it, that and everything you said just rings so true to what playwriting and theater is. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's easy because like the three of us are writers, right? But like it's so hard to have these conversations when it comes to like the industry part of it, right?
Yeah.
The economy of it, which is maybe why like I've kind of charted this path towards PhD land, because then I can avoid the like, I don't know, is this producible question, or like what it, why now, you know? Mm-hmm. Like those questions are so deeply uninteresting to me.
Yeah, so you're about to go get a PhD.
Yeah, PhD school. Yeah.
PhD school.
I'm joining you in this kind of treachery.
Welcome.
Thank you.
The water's fine. Come on in. What do you want to research?
Oh my gosh. So many things, but like so many crazy things that already like aren't what I pitched. Which is fine, right? Like
totally fine.
No one really cares. But I'm like, are these things like too esoteric? Like the other day I was thinking of like near-death experiences.
Ooh.
Oh yeah, maybe I should write about
near-death. In performance?
Yeah, yeah. Or like...
Or as, like, as performance.
Both.
Yeah.
I mean, my big pitch was like, because discard studies is such a new field that was developed by like two Canadian scholars, it hasn't really had the opportunity to be thought of in the context of performance. And really like thinking about it as like a writer, I think I'm thinking about how as humans we synthesize density of things and excess of things, and how does that change our relationship to language very literally on the page and in score. Like kind of concrete poetry, like mise en page, like what are new compositions being made on the page that might reflect our relationship to a growing Anthropocene or a dying environment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also thinking about simulation. I feel like I'm always thinking about like virtuality, how that maybe becomes like a relief from objects. Lately I've been like trying to think about pity a lot.
Interesting.
You know, a lot of my students, when I'm teaching playwriting, like I introduce poetics, Aristotle, and we talk about catharsis, and part of catharsis's definition is about kind of encouraging pity or fear toward a character.
Right.
Pity is such an interesting like translation of pathos, right? So like what is a pitiful dramaturgy? What are like states of abjection or like distancing as relation? I think those are things I'm...
Oh, that sounds fun.
Yeah, but it all feels so disparate, you know. Such sprawling interests. Also cryptids. I'm thinking about cryptids a lot.
What, like, are cryptids?
Like Bigfoot. and the
Loch Ness. Oh, hell yeah.
Like, you know, the mythology of these, like, figures and, like, you know, what is the, like, social or political reason that we've, like, concocted them. You know?
Wow.
Go for that one. I love that one.
You like that one? Like, yeah, that's the fashionable one, right?
So like, Bigfoot counts. What else counts? Like, what's the, how do you categorize a cryptid as opposed to, like, other kinds of monstrous beings?
Well, they're just, like, animals that don't have any proof of existence.
So, like, would a unicorn count?
I don't know, because they always have this kind of foreboding feature to me. Like, I think of, like, Mothman or the Chupacabra or, you know.
So there's something sinister or foreboding.
Yeah, I guess. But maybe a unicorn is a cryptid. I don't know. But I don't know. I don't want to look at a unicorn.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, speaking of foreboding, talk about your play.
Oh, yeah.
404 Not Found.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Maybe you want to tell our listeners, like, what maybe what it's about, what inspired the play?
Oh, gosh, what it's about. maybe what? Y'all can say what it's about. I could tell you what inspired it. Yeah, I mean, I have had, like, a lifelong relationship to insomnia, and that really thrived in 2020, I would say, to the point where, like, so a feature character in this play is, like, Freddy Krueger from the Nightmare on Elm Street series, horror series from the 80s through 2000s. Freddy Krueger is the, like, sinister villain, I'm gonna get you in your sleep character, child serial killer who was murdered by a community of people, and then he haunts their children in their dreams. Famously, Johnny Depp was in the first one as a 19-year-old, I think.
Right.
Yeah, but I saw it, so my older brother showed me that movie when I was very young, way too young. And I was very scared of, like, the kind of burnt face figure of...
Is this the same brother who hit you in the head?
No, different. I have two older,
kind of... Both have damaged you in different ways.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. Two older brothers. Yeah, and, like, it's the perfect kind of horror movie mechanic to, like, infiltrate a like, child subconscious, right? Like, I'm killing children in their sleep. So obviously I'm going to, like, have nightmares about this figure. And as a kid, I, like, developed a relationship to Freddy Krueger. Like, he was, like, in my dreams. And I remember I was so scared of his face. I would always look at his boots. But, like, you know, dream logic, like, you know a person as a person. Or you know a place without it necessarily being spoken. And I remember making a deal with him. I was like, you can live in my subconscious as long as you don't hurt me. Which is such a weird contract to make, like, as a kid. But in 2020, all of a sudden he started coming back in my dreams.
Whoa.
And my therapist was like, you should write about that. And I was like, I should. And I had this, like, development thing with the Kennedy Center that summer, and everything was going online. And I didn't want to work on the project I was originally supposed to work on because I was so angry at, like, this attempt to, like, rehearse a scene in Zoom.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just like, there's no possible way to achieve, like, the kind of cadence or, like, emotional vulnerability that any of us are after. So I started writing this play and monologue.
I see.
It was, like, the only way I felt like I could listen to a play.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting as an exercise, because, like, a lot of my plays have taken this form now where I'm like, okay, how am I thinking of, like, the literariness of...
Yeah.
And, like, why am I still making this a play versus, like, a novella or, like, a short story, right? Mm-hmm. Which I do. I feel very defensive around, like, this writing being theater writing. But, yeah, it's a play mostly monologues, three characters, overlapping, non-overlapping time. I don't know. Lots of simulation. Lots of violence.
And also, it's scary.
Yeah, it's kind of scary, right?
Yeah. Scary.
I'm kind of desensitized to it now because I've read it so many times. But yeah, it's pretty gross, right?
Yeah.
Which, like, violence has, like, existed as a threat in a lot of my plays. And I think as I'm trying to, like, figure out an ethical relationship to that, or, like, what does that look like in theater in a more, like, constructive way? I think having characters describe violence is much more effective than, like, seeing simulated violence on stage. Also, like, I was writing it around the summer of George Floyd, obviously, and I remember watching the kind of Latino community's weird polarization around that time, and like deep unpacking of like Latinidad and like mestizaje, which is historically like a colonial categorization for people who are mixed indigenous and Spanish blood. And it's a real criticized piece of language now in Latin American culture. And I think that's a good thing, because I think often in this conversation around like racial and ethnic ancestry, we talk about the ways we're oppressed, right? And like how that's kind of metabolized through our cellular data. But in thinking about, you know, kind of mixed blood lineage, like you also contain the cellular data of the violators, right?
Right.
Thinking about like how is your body the composite of two things, the oppressor and the oppressed. But that felt very kind of like a low hum in the play, right? Like all these things feel like low hums. Like I really don't want my plays to feel like didactic at all. So they were all just little tendrils.
Have you ever read Maggie Nelson's book, The Art of Cruelty?
No, but I was just looking at it the other day.
It's so good. And I think she writes, basically in that book, she's just looking at the like representations of violence in art. And she spends a lot of time talking about, you know, in performance-based art. And I think you might really like it.
I should read that. I mean, I was looking
at it. I think you should.
Fiction. Yeah.
It's fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you say why you said you feel very defensive that this has to be a play as opposed to like something that's encountered on the page primarily? Can you say why?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like also because language is so important to me, and I think like spoken language is so important to me. Yeah. Like I've definitely shown this play to non-theater people who are reading it and having trouble making sense of it. And I do think there is something enlivened by like hearing actors read it, you know?
Yeah.
And there is a kind of sense, even if it's not a kind of narrative sense made, like a tonal sense made.
Yeah.
And, you know, also because I'm trained as a playwright, like that feels so important to me. Yeah, I don't know. I love plays. Just gonna say that everything I do is a play. But also I think like in the past couple of years, I've just been reading like, I don't know, less plays. And I get so excited by people really holding up the text, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
I want to do this. And I think you're right. I think it's a really different kind of form when you're writing for something to be read, like inside someone's mind versus read aloud. The way that the tension is kind of built, and the way that something works on the ear and the rhythm that's created, I think that makes a lot of sense to me that it might not land in the same way for non-theater people who are just reading it.
Yeah, especially for people who have a hard time like kind of painting the picture in their mind, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm like, oh, you actually need to see the picture in front of you, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what is it for you to see this clay wall? Like, what is it for you to see someone kind of in Freddy Krueger drag, you know? What is a cardboard box? Like, those things feel important that you actually kind of lose when mentioned in passing.
Yeah. Well, and even just the sequential kind of unrolling of something that's time-based, where you can't glance ahead and see what's coming, right? When you're just listening to a piece or watching a piece, you're kind of in that moment all the time, the present moment, finding out what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. And that feels like a really different thinking and experiencing process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. Well, so it's about to be published.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very excited. I really love 53rd State Press. I've been like reading their books since I was in undergrad.
That's so awesome.
I was super honored that they offered me a place in the catalog.
Yeah, listeners, go get it. So when's the publication date?
Well, kind of up in the air. It was supposed to happen this month, but we're finishing cover art, basically. That's the last
piece. Cool. Well, we'll promote it on our socials when it gets
Thank you.
Published.
Appreciate it.
Let's see. I think, well, before we wrap up, we could ask you one more question. That's this game we like to play with our guests. So if you could have a dinner party with any three playwrights, living or dead, who would you invite?
Dead. Yeah, I mean, I guess I would have to err toward dead people, right? Because I'm like, it's such an impossibility.
Yeah.
I mean,
and there's so many more of them.
Right? Like, who would make it the most fun, I guess? like, definitely Jean Genet, because he's such a piece
of nice. That's a first.
Love Jean Genet. Little tricky robber man. I mean, not dead, very much alive. Alicia Harris, like, I love
Harris's
book so much. I mean, Alicia and I have spoken in passing, but I've never had the opportunity to like really sit with her. And she's someone who like loves language, you know, like I'm so in awe. Like, I remember when I saw On Sugarland in New York Theater Workshop a few years ago, I was just so moved by it kind of actively. And I was like, this is someone who's so important. Like, I could feel the importance of her work immediately. Sitting with Alicia would be great. I don't know how Alicia and Jean Genet would get along. who knows? And maybe, well, this week I'm teaching Tim Crouch in class. And I love Tim Crouch's plays so much. Do either of you know him?
No.
I've never heard of him.
British playwright. Like, started as an actor. I think he still acts in a lot of his own plays, but he approaches plays from like a very, very, very conceptual place. And I teach this one play called An Oak Tree a lot that asks like a audience member or just some volunteer to be the other in a two-hander with an earpiece in.
Oh, whoa. I saw a play like that, not by him, but a similar concept. That's so cool.
Yeah. And being like actively fed text without knowing what the a lot of his plays involve audience interaction in different ways that I find really exciting. Like, I think it's a really hard thing to do effectively. But I like the way he thinks about form. So Alicia and Jean Genet.
What a great group.
Yeah. Yeah.
What food would you have on the menu?
Oh my God. What food would we have? I mean, I just ate so much Korean food at this residency and I was like not tired of it the whole time. Our chef, like there's a chef at the Jurassic.
Wow.
Well, I should plug him, Mushi Woosong James. Love Mushi. He's also a performance artist. He was like an alum of the program. And then got hired on to do extra work and be our chef. And he like made the most beautiful Korean meals all the time. So if I could have Mushi's food at this dinner.
Oh, that sounds perfect.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll move on. Oh, actually, one more question.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me think about this. I want to just refer back to you said that you like to challenge this idea of experimental. And I guess for the listeners out there who, you know, who would place that, you know, label like, oh, that's experimental. You know, like, oh, that's not for me. That's experimental.
Yeah.
What advice or like what, how would you want to explain this to those people? Like, how would you want to give that? I'm trying to explain this. Like, how would you give this advice to those who are not something with unfamiliar to embrace?
Yeah. I mean, I think it really becomes less about defining terms and more about like, what are the questions you're really interested in asking? And like, just looking to the word itself, like, what are you trying to experiment with? You know, I think there are some tropes I see in what could be categorized as experimental theater. And I wonder if it's just like coding a piece as something familiar, rather than really trying to like challenge your audience to think in a different way, you know, have a little bit of a perception shift. I guess like easy things that describe experimental to me are like things that don't move in the kind of Aristotelian well-made play, Freytag's Triangle kind of mm-hmm. format, right? But that is to say there are like myriad ways of constructing plays, and it seems kind of foolish to deem everything but, you know, what I just described experimental, right? Like,
right.
It creates this hierarchy, right? Where it's like, oh, this is second rate or like of a different caliber. When I'm like, well, all of that stuff in itself has so many degrees of categorization, right? It's kind of like how I feel about postmodern sometimes. I'm like, what are we saying when we say postmodern?
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I guess in terms of like advice, the privilege we have as playwrights is that we have a direct relationship with our audience. And I think really thinking about not, you know, I got this great advice from Julia Jarko, who is like the head of Brown Now in my last semester of grad school, where, you know, I get so befuddled by the question of like, who is your audience? Mm-hmm. Because I never really know. And I think like a good charge is to think about your play evoking an audience or evoking a public that might not already exist.
Like conjuring it into being.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like in a very idiosyncratic way. And I find that really beautiful. So I'm like, I think that's what the experimentation should err toward. Like, who in particular are you trying to evoke, and what in particular are you trying to ask them to do or think about?
Mm. Yeah. Wow, love that.
Yeah. Cool.
So much to think about.
No.
Ugh, like my taxes. God.
Well. I don't know if you guys can hear my baby, but he's awake from.
There's been a baby this whole time.
You know, this whole time he was sleeping this entire time, and
now he's awake.
So I think he's telling me to wrap up. So move on to Glistens. So Glistens is where we talk about the highlight of the week, what stood out to you. For me, I moved.
Nice.
After almost like, I don't know, I think I was living in LA for the past 10 years, almost 10 years. Mm-hmm. We finally moved up an hour north of LA, Ventura, where my parents live. And it's just nice. Been so awesome. Like, it's just, I just didn't realize how family friendly LA was until I had a child. And then I was like, wow, this city hates moms, hates children, hates me. Yeah. So, we found, and then now Ventura just like fully embrace, like everywhere we go, like we go to the store, there's always someone is a grandmother or a mom. Like that's the sense I get. And they're like, they see my son. They're just like, oh, how old is he? Like, aww. What's he learning now? Oh, and they're all like very, they're all sharing their like anecdotes, like, you know, when they were parents or when their as grandmothers, you know, stuff like that. So I just feel like we're so fully embraced here. Oh, and some restaurants, this is so crazy. Some restaurant, well, this one restaurant we went to, kids under 5 or something eat free Monday, Thursday.
And wow. Like, that's amazing.
Oh my God. Just so many like family friendly things. And I was like,
cool.
I just can't believe for the past year my son was living in a wretched city.
Do you think, Sarah, that moving to the suburbs is the first step of becoming a Republican?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I want nice things. anyway, it's just so fun because, like, yeah, my mom is like hardcore Republican. My family is, and it's just, I mean, I will never. I'm like, I'm never gonna be Republican. But it's like, I just start to see like why like, you know, Republicans are Republican. You know, they're just like, you know what? I'm just like, well, there's some things you know what? Now that I'm becoming a mom and a parent, like I agree with that. Like, yeah, like, but I don't know. They're just they're just lines I'll never cross, and like I'm gonna stay where I am.
But okay, well, keep me posted.
I'll keep you posted. I'll, if anything changes, you'll probably see a rant on social media. Okay, Sam, what's your?
Okay, I started reading this book, and because I'm a PhD student, it's going slowly because I'm doing so many things. But I started reading this book that I highly recommend called Marks for Cats, in which the author declares that all history is the history of cat struggle. Her name is Lee Claire LaBerge. It's really good, you guys. It's just all about like
– Yeah.
Yeah. It's like – You know, there are some books that the ideas are cool, but the writing's not that great. But this book, the ideas are cool, and the writing is so enjoyable.
Nice.
So check it out. Marks for Cats.
Marks for Cats?
Yeah, like, you know, like Marxism.
Oh, Marxism. I was like, Marx?
You know, Marxism. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, bring Marxism to Ventura. That's really like,
yeah,
I'm gonna save you.
That's a play right there. Lucas, what about you? What's your glisten?
I'm like halfway through this documentary right now. That's so beautiful.
Like one that you're watching, you mean?
Yeah. Oh my god. Could you imagine if I made a documentary and
I wanted to clarify.
Beautiful. Like talking about my own documentary. No,
there are people like that.
God, I hope I never be like that. No, it's called Keyboard Fantasies. It's about Beverly Glenn Copeland, who's like a American Canadian musician, like trans man who like made work when he was young, but really wasn't discovered until much later in life. And like, it's kind of the story of like in his 70s, like him collaborating with all of these like young musicians who've really come to like celebrate his kind of like folky, synthy music. It's just so wholesome.
Cool.
So that, and it's like great music. Definitely recommend his music. And then I've also just been listening to, I mean, the beautiful thing about residencies is you meet so many like incredibly talented people. And
yeah,
composer friend, he's a Taiwanese composer, Xuan Cheng. He has this really gorgeous album that I've been listening to as I write, which is so nice.
Oh, nice.
It's called Earthing. I think it's on Spotify. Yeah. Music is good.
I'm gonna check that out.
I love music. Yeah. Cool. Well, Lucas, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh yeah, where can our listeners find you?
In Brooklyn.
Do you have any online presence that you would like to plug?
I'm not like a big social. Well, that's a lie. I like Instagram. I have Instagram, Luke Baish, LucBaisch. And then my website, lucasbaisch.com, has my email, new play exchange, but like I've kind of been removing my plays because I want people to buy them when they're published.
Yeah.
But you can read about my plays. Yeah, and if any of you are in the Bay Area in the next 5 years, I will be there. So, you know, cool. Hit me up.
Amazing. All right. Well, thanks so much for coming on our show, Lucas.
Yeah, I'm so honored. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Beckett's Babies. If you enjoyed what you heard or learned a thing or two about playwriting, be sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast with your friends.
And if you'd like to reach out and share with us your thoughts on playwriting and theater, or maybe be a guest on the show, be sure to visit our website at www.beckettsbabies.com. That's www.beckettsbabies.com, and you can contact us there. Thanks for listening.